Last week, we read about Jesus attending a wedding in Cana and performing his first miraculous sign, displaying his glory. From there, Jesus went to Jerusalem, and many people were convinced he was the Messiah, but Jesus didn't trust them because he knew human nature. He had a significant conversation with a Pharisee, Nicodemus, and then with a Samaritan woman at Jacob's well while passing through Samaria. Then he returned to Galilee, to Cana. We begin today's reading at John chapter 4, verse 46. So he, Jesus, came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come down from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. As he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, "Yesterday, at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee.
Good morning, everyone. Where do you go when you're at the end of your rope? I want to be clear, I am not talking about where you go when you flunk a midterm or get into a fender bender. This is not about when plan A fails. This is about when all of your plans and all of your desperate hopes of a whiff of a plan fail. Where do you go when the doctors stop pretending to offer courses of treatment? Where do you go when your spouse won't show up at home or for marital counseling? Where do you go when you're 63 years old with no retirement savings and no supportive children and no useful job skills and you have in your hand the pink slip that your boss just handed you? Where do you go when you're at the end of your rope? This is a story about a man at the end of his rope. He is an official, a servant of the king, like many of us. He is wealthier than average, more educated than average, better connected than average, and none of it is going to do him any good. His son is going to die, and he can't do anything about it. The story unfolds as a sort of double drama, where we gradually get revelation of who Jesus is, and we gradually get the official's response to who Jesus is. And that's how we're going to unpack the story this morning, through revelation and response. Both of these things happen over the course of the story in three stages. So first, revelation. In three stages, the story reveals who Jesus is. The first stage is verses 46 to 48, and they reveal that Jesus is powerful. So Jesus came again to Galilee, to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for his son was at the point of death. So Jesus said to him, "Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe." This Jesus, he can do strange and wonderful and apparently delicious things. he is powerful. He can make things happen. And his power, notice in this story, it's not limited to manipulating physical reality. It's not just about changing the substance of a liquid or banishing the presence of a fever. Jesus has power over inner reality too. He can see right through people. Peer into their souls the way you might peer into a fish tank. When he meets the official, he immediately identifies the inner state of the official's heart. Unless you see signs and wonders, you won't believe. Jesus doesn't have to ask the official penetrating questions. He doesn't have to go on a long fishing trip and hang out with the official. He doesn't have to follow the official around in a lab coat making notes on a clipboard. He just knows. Jesus is powerful. We see that right from the start. I think all of us, no matter what box you might check on a religious census, we would all go this far with Jesus. There is something strangely powerful about him. I mean, if nothing else, without raising great sums of money or conquering vast swaths of territory, he managed to start the most influential movement in history. So there has to be something there. There's some sort of power. The question is, what is it? And what do we do with it? Lots of people have been powerful. But that power is only any good if it is used well. And in Jesus' case, we find that it is used well. You see, the first stage of revelation in the story is that Jesus is powerful. But the second stage in verses 49 and 50 is that Jesus is gracious. So the official said to Jesus, "Sir, come down before my child dies." Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live." Here Jesus uses his power to give the official a gift he does not deserve. The official comes to Jesus with nothing. He has nothing to barter with. Jesus doesn't owe him anything. In fact, the official, the word that John uses makes it clear, the official is a servant of King Herod, who by this time has probably executed Jesus' cousin, John. So they're not on the same side. Jesus is not friends with this guy. And then Jesus peers into the official's soul and he sees only lack, only weakness, only the absence of belief. And Jesus chooses to use his power to give the official a gift, to give him his son's life. Jesus is gracious. Jesus gives the gift of life not as a good deal. This is not something that pops up on Amazon on Cyber Monday. And it's not a gift with strings attached. This isn't your mother-in-law giving you baby clothes with the clear expectation that you will then pay for professional photography of her grandson in those clothes. That's not what Jesus is doing here. Jesus is genuinely gracious. Jesus gives the official's son life. So Jesus is powerful and Jesus is gracious. But who is he to give life? To imply, as he does throughout the Gospel of John, that apart from him, we don't have life. That's a pretty audacious claim. And it's answered in the third stage of Revelation, where we learn that Jesus is God. Not an extraordinary man, not a divine sort of being. God. In verses 51 to 53, Jesus does something that only God can do. This is going to take a few minutes, but observe. Verses 51 to 53. As the official was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better, and they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." So Jesus is in Cana, and he speaks simple words, "Your son will live." Up until this point, The kid has been circling the drain. The ICU staff is just trying to make him comfortable. And then Jesus says, your son will live, and the fever goes away. And the illness is gone. This is way beyond working wonders. Okay? And that would have been blindingly obvious to people who lived in Judea. So the most well-known wonder worker in the Old Testament in the story of Israel's history was a man named Elijah. And Elijah actually found himself in a similar situation at one point in his ministry. He was living with a widow and the widow's son. And the widow's son dies, and the widow comes to Elijah and says the same thing the official says. Could you help me out here? And this is how Elijah responds. 1 Kings chapter 17, beginning in verse 19. And Elijah said to the widow, give me your son. And he took him from her arms and carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged and laid him on his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, O Lord, my God, have you brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by killing her son? Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord. O Lord, my God, let this child's life come into him again. And the Lord listened to the voice of Elijah. And the life of the child came into him again, and he revived. This is the official's last desperate hope. That Jesus is like Elijah, and he will respond like Elijah did. He'll come down to Capernaum and lay himself upon his little boy and pray for God to heal him. And Jesus deliberately does none of that. He doesn't pick up the official's son and lay him in bed and stretch himself. He doesn't even go to the same town. Jesus doesn't pray here at all. He doesn't come before the Almighty and plead for the life of this little boy. Why? Because he is the Almighty. So he just says, your boy will live. The official is thinking back into his history, into the Old Testament, and picturing Elijah. Jesus is thinking back into the Old Testament, but he has different verses in mind from the end of Isaiah chapter 55, where God speaks about himself. And God says, as the rain and the snow come down from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth, causing it to bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be. When it goes out from my mouth, it shall not return to me empty. But it will accomplish all that I purpose, and it will succeed in the thing for which I send it. God says, when I speak, what I say happens. And Jesus says, your son will live, and the boy lives. Only God's words work that way. Only God's words are that kind of powerful and effective. On Friday morning, I woke the kids up to get them ready for school, and I put breakfast on the table for them, and then I took a shower. But before I got into the shower, I spoke to them with words of great power and authority. I didst say, children, take heed. Thou shalt finish thine breakfast, and then go into thy bedroom, and attire themselves in garments befitting the brisk autumn weather. And then thou shalt brush thy teeth and thine hair, and place thine shoes upon thine feet. I'm not going to go into detail as to what I encountered when I got out of the shower. Suffice it to say that my words returned to me empty. They did not accomplish all that I purposed or succeed in the things for which I sent them. I mean, duh. Right? If I want my kids to get ready for school, I don't just get to decree it. I have to encourage and remind and exhort and threaten and occasionally bribe in order to cause what I want to happen to happen. That's how my words work. And that's how your words work. And that's how Elijah's words work. But that's not how Jesus' words work. Because Jesus is not Elijah reborn. He's not just another prophet with a backstage pass into heaven. Jesus is the Lord of heaven. Jesus is the Word made flesh. Jesus is God who dwelt in inapproachable light, coming down into the midst of our darkness in order that by His dwelling upon us, His light might shine on us. Jesus is God. Nothing less. That's the fullness of Revelation. And until you have seen Jesus in His divinity and seen all the rest of the world lit up by His Godhood, you haven't really seen Him. Jesus is God. Full stop. That's the truth about Him. That demands a response. Knowing that demands a response. And not a response of mere curiosity or gratitude or deference. Knowing that Jesus is God demands a response that's going to take a lifetime to work out. And in our story, we see the official beginning to work that out. Beginning to respond or respond to what is revealed about Jesus. The response in this story, and for all of us, is belief. John very deliberately structures this story around three instances of the word believe, corresponding to three stages in the official's growing belief. And we'll get into those three stages. Before we do, you need to understand that in John's entire gospel, and really in the whole New Testament, belief is the crucial response to Jesus. There's a moment a couple of chapters later in chapter 6, verses 28 and 29, when people, they're like, cool, Jesus, we're with you. What do we do now? This is verses 28 and 29. Then the crowd said to Jesus, what must we do to be doing the works of God? How do we respond to you? And Jesus answered them, this is the work of God, singular, one work, that you believe in Him whom God has sent. That's the whole thing. Believing in Jesus, it's not the beginning of responding, it's the whole deal. It's not the first step in the right direction, it's the entire journey. And belief, in the Bible, belief is not mental assent. Belief is active, dependent trust. So it's not that you believe in the atmosphere in the sense that you agree in theory that there's this sort of cloud around the earth that's about 80% nitrogen and 18% oxygen and some other stuff. No, belief is taking a breath. And then taking another one. And then taking another one. And continually drawing life out of the air. Actively, every day, forever. Depending on the atmosphere. That's belief. And that's the response Jesus demands. So, three stages of belief in this story. In this story, the first stage of belief is absence. There's no belief at the beginning of the story. Jesus is clear, verse 48. Unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. So the first stage of the official's belief is that he doesn't believe. He's not trusting in Jesus, he just has nowhere else to go. He's desperate, he might as well give this guy a shot. He's heard some good things. The first stage of belief is its absence. And Jesus takes care of him. Jesus says, you don't believe? Here's what you would need to believe. Let me give you what you need. Even the belief that you are supposed to have in Jesus comes from Jesus. So what matters first is not the depth of your belief or the maturity of your belief or the constancy or even the reality of your belief. God is able to take the faintest spark or the coldest ember of belief and make a bonfire. God is even able to take no belief whatsoever and create belief out of nothing, just like he once took no universe whatsoever and create a universe out of nothing. So maybe you're here and you don't believe at all. What you have when it comes to Jesus is the absence of belief. If so, okay, you're in exactly the right starting place. Or maybe belief rises out of your soul like the Himalayas, still growing. I mean, great. Or maybe your belief isn't at all like the Himalayas. It's like those tiny islands that disappear twice a day at high tide. You flip back and forth between saying, I think I'm a Christian, and no, probably not. Or maybe it used to be like the Himalayas, but all of the years of sorrow have worn it down and eroded it, and it is low and rounded and slump-shouldered. The point is, it doesn't matter. At the beginning, it's not belief that you need. It's Jesus. Come to Jesus. My friend Adam explains it this way. It's one of my favorite illustrations. When he had small kids, he would take them by the hands and spin them around like this with their feet up in the air. And before he would take their hands, every time he would say the same thing, hold on tight. Right? And I mean, was it good if the kids held on tight? Sure. Did it matter if they held on tight? No. Adam was not entrusting his three-year-old's life to his three-year-old's grip. What mattered was that he was holding on. All that is necessary is for you to place your hands in the Father's hands. All that is necessary is for you to come to Jesus. It's not the strength of your grip, but the strength of his that will save you. The first stage of belief is the absence of belief. The second stage, again, is in verses 49 to 50, and this is the stage of obedience. So the official said to Jesus, Sir, come down before my child dies. Jesus said to him, Go, your son will live. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. So Jesus the official believes what Jesus tells him, and he demonstrates that belief by doing what Jesus told him to do, by going. Now, I admit this is speculative, but I don't think that the official walked away experiencing perfect peace, that there was just this total lack of anxiety in his soul, and he whistled the entire walk back to Capernaum. Belief is not signaled by being at ease at all times. The point is that the official did what Jesus told him to do. This is still not the fullness of belief. The official has no clue that Jesus is God made flesh. This is much more like trusting your doctor. You go to the doctor, and the doctor takes your blood pressure and says, that is too high. Take these meds, exercise 5 times a week, cut way back on salt and cholesterol. And you might walk out of there thinking, I don't know if I'm going to do that. I don't know if it's worth it to do that. This doesn't sound like very much fun. But if you take the pills and go jogging and eat more kale salad, then you are believing in the doctor. It's only belief if you obey. When Vanessa and I first moved to Corvallis, we put a map of the city in the front seat of our minivan so that we wouldn't get lost. Now, did the existence of the map in our minivan, was that in and of itself going to help at all? No. It only helped if we regularly consulted it and then did what it told us to do. That was proof that we were trusting in the map. Otherwise, the map was useless. Belief is only belief if it obeys. So, how is Jesus calling you to believe? specifically? Is there someone you need to forgive? Is there someone you need to go to and ask forgiveness? Is there a habit in your life, some festering weed that needs to be pulled out and put to death and never seen again? Or is there a habit missing from your life that you know would be good but is crowded out by other things less life-giving? And Jesus is calling you to make space for it. Will you believe in him? The second stage of belief is obedience. It's coming to Jesus and listening. The third stage of belief is worship. This is how the story ends in verse 53. The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." This is the epiphany, the revelation. Jesus is not just Elijah 2.0. And he himself believed, and all his household. Look, worshiping something means that you value it supremely, that it matters more to you than anything else. And the official sees Jesus do something that only God can do, and he responds with worship, with belief that has no limits, that isn't specific to one thing that Jesus asked him to do, but is general to his entire life. The official looks upon the full revelation of Jesus and responds with the fullness of belief. In verse 50, right, Jesus tells him something and he does it. But now his questions to Jesus, they're not going to be specific. They're not going to be, "Hey, Jesus, can you help me get this other thing that I value more?" Because he's learning to worship, to value Jesus supremely. So now his questions will all be about, how can I get as close to you as possible? How can I better follow you? How can I know you more? What would you have of me? That's the third stage of belief. Those are the questions of worship. So in this stage, you are not coming to Jesus anymore because he is powerful and gracious enough to hook you up with other things. You are not treating Jesus like a benevolent and well-off grandparent whose presence you tolerate as long as the ice cream that they buy you is big enough. You are coming to Jesus just for his own sake, for the pleasure of being with him. In worship, you come to Jesus because you are beginning to understand not that all of the other things that you want in life are bad, but that Jesus is far, far better. This is our call in life. To come to Jesus out of every circumstance and in every way. Because in him, we find the richest and the fullest of all possible lives. So this is your call in desperate and extraordinary circumstances like the official faced. Andrew Brunson is a pastor in our group of churches, the EPC, and he recently spent 2 years imprisoned in Turkey for his belief in Jesus. Listen to him describing that desperate end of his rope time. He said, "I expected a supernatural sense of God's presence, and when I didn't get it, it really shocked me. I didn't know how I would make it. But I thought, wait, I need to fight for my faith, for my belief. Because if I lose this, I've lost everything." That's not belief that Jesus will get me what I want. That's belief that Jesus is what I want. Andrew thought he needed a supernatural experience, and Jesus didn't give him that. But Jesus did hold on to him. Jesus did give him what he needed to believe. And in the end, Andrew says, that gave him a different sense of confidence in Jesus, of belief. And it took me into a deeper intimacy. Andrew was in, I know no better way of describing it, hell on earth. And he came to Jesus And Jesus didn't give him what he asked for. But Jesus did give him life. When you are desperate, when you are at the very end of your rope, come to Jesus. Coming to Jesus is also your call in the kind of everyday moments, in what Henry David Thoreau called your quiet desperation. Sometimes we can imagine having a belief that is heroic and all would just pass right by the types of belief that are frankly kind of boring, mundane. Listen to the words of Anglican priest Tish Harrison Warren from her book, Liturgy of the Ordinary. She said, "I spent a few months in a war-torn area of the world, and I was surprised to find that there, in the midst of tensions and dangers, I felt far more at peace than in my average American housebound day with a baby and a toddler. I had a theology of suffering. I had a belief that allowed me to pay attention in times of crisis, to see small flickers of mercy in profound darkness. But my theology was too big to touch a typical day in my life. I developed the habit of ignoring God in the midst of the daily grind." Most days we don't get to be heroes. Most days we don't face desperation. Most days we face drudgery. Life seems less like an overwhelming darkness and more like an endless twilight. In those days, come to Jesus. So where do you go when you're at the end of your rope? Whether it's your darkest hour or another gray day fraying at the edges of your weary soul, where do you go? Come to Jesus. My question at this point, and maybe it's yours too, is what if I haven't seen reason to come to Jesus? I mean, the official went to Jesus, and then, you know, hours later, he knew that his son was living, that Jesus had delivered. But we brought Elizabeth to Jesus, and Jesus didn't heal her. Now we're bringing Pastor Mark to Jesus, and Jesus hasn't healed him yet. Like, we'll keep trying, but we haven't seen it. So what if the official has good reason to trust this guy? But we don't. What do we do then? That's my question. And God's answer is hidden in this text. He says, "You do have reason to trust me. You're just not looking in the right place." Jesus said to the official, "Go. Your son will live." That sounds like he's giving the official what he wants. He's actually giving much, much more. The official's little boy was dying. And so he comes to Jesus saying, "Make my boy stop dying. Make his heart beat strong and his brain waves function and his cells do what they're supposed to do." There's a Greek word for that. It's bios, as in biology. But Jesus didn't say to the official, "Go, your son will bios." He uses a different word for life. He uses the word zoe, which means life as it's meant to be. Zoe means life that soars, that sings, life that is bursting with joy and peace and justice and harmony. And Jesus says, "I'm going to give your son that." Jesus never says a word about how he's going to do it. You see, Jesus, master of all material reality, could give that little boy bios, just go, your son. His heart will work. But in order for that boy to really live, in order for the official son to really live, God's son had to really die. For God so loved the world that he gave his one and only son, that whoever believes in him would not die, but have everlasting life. Everlasting Zoe. The official is grateful to Jesus, but not nearly grateful enough. He has no idea what it cost Jesus to keep that promise. And frankly, neither do we. We'll never know how much it cost to see our sin upon that cross. Even so, coming to Jesus at the foot of the cross, saying daily to him, "Jesus, I'm at the end of my rope. I have nowhere else to go. I might be able to keep my heart beating today, but Zoe is out of my reach and I want to live." A habit of coming to Jesus will grow belief in us. So have you not seen in your life reason to trust the power and the grace of Jesus? Very well. Look at the cross where Jesus died for you and proved the depth of his grace. And look at the empty tomb where Jesus conquered death on your behalf and proved the height of his power. Come to Jesus. He probably won't give you what you're asking for, but he will give you life that is far more abundant than all you would dare ask for or imagine. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for coming to us. Thank you for coming for us. Thank you for dying that we might have life. Thank you for giving us even the belief, even the faith that we need to draw near to you and find life in you. It is all grace, and we acknowledge that. Teach us to believe. Teach us to acknowledge how much we need you. Teach us to trust and obey you. Teach us to worship you, to see you as you really are, God made flesh, supremely valuable, with no rival. Give us life as it was meant to be. Give us life in you.